Good morning, everybody. Sorry for the delay. Sorry for the Zoom delay. This is the third lecture in my series on the literature of the Second Temple period. The first week, we talked about the Apocrypha, religious material, religious literature that did not make it into the Tanakh. The second week, we talked about Josephus, who was the first secular historian in Jewish history. Today, I want to talk about religious leadership, a different kind of religious leadership, and that's re sorry, religious literature, sorry. And that's the Mishnah. That's the beginning of the Mishnah. And that's really the transition to a religious literature that became the foundation of all Jewish literature subsequent to that period. And what I want to do is I want to look at the Mishnah in a slightly different way than the way that we usually look at the Mishnah. And that is that I'd like to talk a little bit about the history of the development of the Mishnah. And then I'd like to talk about two of the Tanaim, two of the rabbis in the Mishnah, and to try to understand their personalities, their relationships, and how they began to shape the early Mishnah. Let's start at the beginning. The most significant date in Jewish history, at least in Jewish history that we have today, is 70 CE. That's the day that the temple was destroyed. You see, before 70 CE, the center of religion and culture was Jerusalem and was the temple, was the Beit HaMikdash. After 70, obviously there was no Beit HaMikdash. The Jews no longer lived in Jerusalem. The question is, what were the Jews to do? So we have a famous Gemara. The Gemara tells us that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was snuck out of the city of Jerusalem, and he was given one wish by Vespasian, by the Roman Caesar, and that's what he said was, "Tein li Yavne v'chachameha." Give me Yavne and its scholars. And again, the tradition is that Yavne replaced Jerusalem. I told you, I think last week, that Josephus tells us that Yavne was really no more than a refugee camp. But it was a place that was transformed by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and by his colleagues into the center of Judaism post-Temple. And this was done in two very specific ways. Obviously, this is a more complicated conversation, but this was done in two ways. Number one is that prayer replaced sacrifices, and the Beit HaKnesset, the synagogue, replaced the Beit HaMikdash. Now we know that in the time of the temple, there were two sacrifices given. A daily sacrifice in the morning, and a tamid, a daily sacrifice in the afternoon. And then there were some sacrifices that were allowed to stay on the Mizbeach, on the altar, all night long. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said that after the destruction of the temple, in commemoration of the fact that we no longer have those sacrifices, so we're going to introduce davening, three prayers a day, in place of the sacrifices. To us today, that seems pretty standard. Right? That's what we do. We daven instead of giving sacrifices. But when you think about it, that was a tremendously courageous move on Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. The idea that you're going to replace sacrifice, korbanot, with tefillah, to most people would say, that's sacrilegious. How can you do that? Sacrifices, as described by the Torah, that's the way you worship God. Who says that davening three times a day should be as good as giving sacrifices? So actually, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was courageous and, in a sense, took a big chance, but he was successful. And the davenings that we do today, the fact that we daven three times a day today, is a reflection, without any question, of the courage of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. The second thing that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did was that study replaced service. And that is that there's no temple, so there's no place for people to congregate to give sacrifices. So the Beit HaMidrash replace The Beit HaMidrash replaced the Beit HaMikdash. And the Gemara says in a number of places, Ein LaKadosh Baruch Hu Ela Dalet Amot Shel Halacha Bilvad, that God only has the four cubits of halacha, means that God moved from the temple to the Beis HaMedrash, to the place of learning. So what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai does is that he really, in a sense, transforms Judaism as we know it. And it was a crisis. What are you going to do without the Beis HaMikdash? So number one, what he does is he replaces karbanot, sacrifices, with prayer. And number two, what he does is he replaces the temple with the Beit HaMidrash, with the study hall. And here we really appreciate for a second how Judaism was transformed post the year 70. And that is that pre-70, or at least in the time when the Beis HaMikdash was functioning, there was some interim period there at the end of the Beis HaMikdash where things weren't doing so well. But when things were doing well, the Sanhedrin, the court, the center of Jewish learning and Jewish adjudication, was found in the Beis HaMikdash. And all of Jewish life centered around the Beis HaMikdash. Post-70, no more sacrifices. Prayer replaces sacrifice. In a sense, prayer is much more democratic. We might come back to that. Prayer is democratic. Prayer is open to everybody, while sacrifices were available for everybody. The point of sacrifices were it was hard to give a sacrifice. You had to make your way to Jerusalem. So prayer was much easier. Anybody could pray whenever they wanted to pray. So prayer replaces sacrifice. And the Beit HaMidrash, the local study hall, maybe even your home, replaces the Beit HaMikdash. That also was an important thing. And the
Rabbi,
last,
I'm
yeah,
going
yes.
to interrupt for half a second. Okay, I think you're sharing. It should work. And if you could turn on your video, and your video isn't on, like your picture.
My video should be on because it says video.
In other words, your picture. I don't know, but okay, it's not on. But see if you can share your
There are
screen.
two. There are two. I actually have two screens on because I couldn't get on. One screen should have my picture, and one screen doesn't. Shoshana, can you bring me my iPad, please? Okay, sorry, we're having a wait, I went from one computer to the other, and it must be that my screen on my other computer is not working correctly. I
Okay, can you
apologize.
share your screen though? That's
I
your share.
cannot.
No, now, even now?
I cannot. Can you share it as the host?
I never got your thing that you sent me, but there's no reason you shouldn't be able to share your screen, but give me one second because
I don't control that, Kenny.
it says, yeah, allow. Okay, now share your screen. It's not, you know what? It's obviously broken because it's not letting me, yeah, it's not letting, I don't know why, but
Says host disabled attendee screen sharing.
but, but I didn't. That's the funny thing. I'm allowing, yeah, if you go.
You should be able to do it. You want me to send you an email?
Yeah, you can, but there's something really strange here, but just let me. Okay.
Shoshana Dale.
All right, send me the email, I guess.
I
Yeah.
sent you the email. Can you see me now?
No. I don't think so.
And he wasn't Gail's iPhone. This was
He was
him.
English twin too. Yeah, but they're both. He said, "Give me your tablet." So maybe there's two of them.
All right, give us a minute. We'll work this out.
There's probably a whole cottage industry of people to help people with those.
Okay.
You are the host. You should be. I just sent you an email. You should be able to share my screen.
Oh, getting better.
But I don't know what I'm supposed to share. Okay, I don't know. Go on.
I just sent you an email.
It's not working yet.
I just Googled this. There's a huge problem with Zoom all over the place. If you just
right, that's what we heard. There's problems with Zoom around the world. Yes, we did hear that.
Did you get my email, Rabbi?
We broke it.
We should feel honored that we're part of the international crisis this morning.
Yes, I did. And I'm going to put it on the chat box. Okay, does everybody see it? I just shared it.
Nope. I don't see it.
I just put it on the chat box.
No, you shouldn't. You should be able to share it as a screen.
Oh, this I have no idea how to do.
Just go share screen.
Right.
Does it let you share screen?
Says one participant can share at a time. That means you should be able to share your screen.
I cannot.
Okay.
So you go copy the URL. Sorry, we're just going to get this right because the whole class is going to depend on everybody.
Copy the URL. Yeah, where do I put it? I hit share screen.
Yeah, so then there should be a drop-down box which says URL, copy URL.
Sorry, I don't see that.
Do you see where it says share screen?
Yes.
What comes up?
A whole bunch of things on my computer.
Not much. I'm just looking to the Zoom. Can I call you back?
20 boxes. Just,
so then
no,
put
no,
in, okay. If it comes on your computer, just put
he's
my
doing
URL
Spanish now. Can he call
in
you back?
Your, in your Chrome and just share your Chrome. Easy. Just share your Chrome.
I wish I knew how to do that.
Just click on your Chrome. You'll be able to share it.
Okay. Click on Chrome. I click on Chrome. But your thing isn't there when I click on Chrome.
Put in my URL, then click on Chrome.
I have no idea where to put it in. I'm sorry.
I'm doing the time right stuff for
okay, so we'll just go this way. Sorry. Okay. Apologize. Jay, if you figure it out, put it on. It's important to have it on. I don't know why. I apologize.
If everybody could mute themselves.
Yeah, everybody should mute yourself. Okay. I now can people see me?
No.
I'm muted.
I can know.
That's so weird because I can see, I apologize because I can see myself. You see one that says 929 English?
Yeah.
And I'm not there.
No.
I'm not there. That is so strange. I apologize. Okay, I guess it's just gonna have to be audio. I apologize for the fact that that something is not working well.
Am I visible, Sulzbach?
I actually don't see anybody either.
Okay, so
the only sorry, we're just gonna take 1 second, then we'll figure this out. The only person that I see is me. So obviously there's a problem with the video. If I tell them, I guess there's a problem with
yeah, just video. Go on. We'll have to deal with that.
If everybody sorry.
You don't need my call. You're gonna use your call.
Sorry for the sorry for the interruption. If everybody could please mute themselves, that would be helpful.
I just muted everybody. Everybody's muted.
Okay. And Rabbi Kelman, if you figure out how to share that would be great. If not, now I'm not sure if the chat box is working, but I sent in the chat box, I sent a link to the source sheet that I'm going to be using. Let me just see if that's going to work for me.
Okay, I would just go on.
Okay, so the last point that I wanted to make, which I think maybe is the most important point of all, is the fact that after 70, the leadership role among the Jewish people changes as well. And that is that pre-70, obviously the leadership of the Jewish people was within the, was with the Kohanim, the people who served in the temple. After 70, after the destruction of the temple, instead of the Kohanim running the show, it moved to the people in Yavne, the people who eventually called themselves the rabbis. Now, what I want to do is I want to try to understand how these rabbis, these early rabbis, began to shape the oral tradition, the literature that became known eventually as the Mishnah. The first question is, where did they get the authority from, right? Who says that these rabbis, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and the rabbis in Yavne, who said that they had the authority to make the laws, or that they had the authority to be the leaders, the way the Kohanim were the leaders? So I think the first thing we have to start with is the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, u'mesara liYoshua, v'Yoshua lizakenim, and so what does that mean? Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, u'mesara liYoshua. Moshe received the Torah on Sinai, and he gave it to Yoshua. Yoshua to the Zakenim, Zakenim to Neviim, and the Neviim misarua lanshe Knesset Hagdolah. They sent it to the members of the Great Assembly. Now that Mishnah, ironically, and we'll talk about this in a second, ironically, that Mishnah appears at the beginning of Maseches Avos, Pirkei Avos, which in a sense is a fine place for it to appear. But that Mishnah actually justifies and gives credibility to the rabbis. Okay. What right do the rabbis have to determine the law, to develop the law? Moshe kibel Torah miSinai Masara liYoshua v'Yoshua lizakenim. That there's an unbroken chain back to Moshe on Har Sinai. That's what gave these rabbis that authority. Now, what I want to do this morning is, rather than talk about the rabbis in general, what I want to do is I want to focus on two of the most famous rabbis, and I want to show how these rabbis, through the way that the Talmud describes their personalities, their leadership roles, how they were able to take a leadership position. And those two rabbis that I want to talk about today are Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Again, if you're in the chat box and you are able to to copy my sheet, so you will see that you'll be able to follow along. If you're not, that's okay too, and you can I will read it for you. The first rabbi I want to talk about today is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is born around the year 50 CE. Now that's a very important time, because that means that Rabbi Akiva basically is born before the destruction of the temple and comes of age later after the destruction of the temple. So he maybe more than anybody represents and reflects the transition period. The Gemara in Ksuvos tells an unbelievable story about Rabbi Akiva. The Gemara says, and I'll just read it, at least this Gemara I'll read in English. The Gemara further relates, Rabbi Akiva was the shepherd of Ben Kalba Savua, one of the wealthiest residents of Jerusalem. The daughter of Ben Kalba Savua saw that he was humble and refined. So we have a story of Rabbi Akiva, who was a shepherd, right? The furthest from being a student of the law. And he works for a rich person. The daughter of Kalba Savua saw him and saw that he was humble and refined. She said to him, if I betroth myself to you, will you go to the study hall to learn Torah? He said to her, yes. She became betrothed to him privately and sent him off to study. Her father heard this and became angry. He removed her from his house and took a vow, prohibiting her from benefiting from her property. So here you have a classic story, right? Rabbi Akiva works as a shepherd for the rich man. The daughter's impressed. She wants him to go and learn. The father becomes angry, and he basically writes her out of the will. Rabbi Akiva went and sat for 12 years in the study hall. When he came back to his house, he brought 12,000 students with him. And as he approached, he heard an old man saying to his wife, For how long will you lead the life of a widow of a living man, living alone while your husband is in another place? She said to him, if he would listen to me, he would sit and study for another 12 years. When Rabbi Akiva heard this, he said, I have permission to do this. He went back and he sat for another 12 years in the study hall. When he came back, he brought 24,000 students with him. His wife heard and went out toward him to greet him. Her neighbors said, borrow some clothes and wear them, as your current apparel is not appropriate to meet an important person. She said to them, a righteous man understands the life of his beast. When she came to him, she fell on her face and kissed his feet. His attendants pushed her away as they did not know who she was. And he said to them, leave her alone, as my Torah knowledge and yours is actually hers. Now, first let me tell you, when I read this story, the thing to me, if everybody can mute themselves, it would just be helpful. When I read this story, the thing that always strikes me about this story is, let's just take it for a minute. He goes away for 12 years, and then he comes back and he hears somebody saying to his wife that, you know, how can you go on living like a widow? And she said, I wish he would go and learn another 12 years. And when Rabbi Akiva heard this, he went back and he studied for another 12 years. Now, my question has always been, I don't understand why Rabbi Akiva didn't at least go to say hello to his wife. He came all the way. He came back. He heard that she said that he was going to study for another 12 years. It seems ironic that he didn't even go inside and say hello to her before he went back and learned 12 years. But I think here we have a few things that are important to understand. First of all, the famous Rabbi Akiva. What you see about Rabbi Akiva is his total and complete dedication to Torah. Not only did he study 12 years, not only did he study 24 years, but actually he didn't even say hello to his wife in the interim. He didn't even go inside to say hello. And when he came back with 24,000 students. That, of course, is a significant number, and that's what, you know, they died during Sfiras HaOmer, Shelo Nagu, Kavod Zeh LaZeh, but leave that aside for now. Now, the other important thing here to notice, and of course, the idea of a wife recognizing the greatness of her husband is also a fascinating topic here. But what I find that's important here is the very beginning of the story. The daughter of Ben Kalba Savua saw that he was humbled and refined. That what are the qualities that she finds in Rabbi Akiva? He's not a learned man. He's a shepherd of her father. But he's humble and he's refined. And that's what makes a difference to her. So this story has a lot of different pieces to it. And this story is an amazing story. But I think this story as an introduction to Rabbi Akiva really presents Rabbi Akiva, I think, number one, as a real person. And I think we sometimes forget that. When we study the Mishnah and we study the Gemara, we know Rabbi Akiva, we know all of his opinions, but what was he really like? And here we gain an insight into what he was really like. I'll just comment for a second to say that, you know, when you learn Gemara, especially when you learn Gemara in yeshiva, the Gemara teachers don't like to see the Tanoim and Amoraim, the rabbis and the Mishnah and the Gemara, as being, so to speak, real people. In a sense, what they try to do is they try to flatten out the playing field. Everybody's the same. They're all Tanaim, they're all Amoraim. It doesn't matter that Rabbi Akiva was humbled and refined. It doesn't matter that he studied for 24 years. It's what his opinion. Because the minute that you introduce his personality, the minute that you talk about one person being somehow holier than the next, so in a sense, you tip the balance in terms of the legal discussion. And the rabbis in the Gemara and those who've studied Gemara since then have been very careful not to tip that balance. And that's why, even though these stories do exist in the Gemara, these are not the most famous stories. And that's why what I really want to do today is I want to try to gain a perspective on at least two of the Tanaim in terms of who they were, what their background is, and why they were important. That's the first story about Rabbi Akiva, where he came from, his commitment, his humility and his refinement. Now, maybe, and again, there are so many famous stories about Rabbi Akiva. Maybe the most famous story about Rabbi Akiva is the story that appears at the end of Maseches Makos. And here I'll read the story in Hebrew and translate it into English. Pamachas hayu olim liYerushalayim. On another occasion, these rabbis were going up to Jerusalem after the destruction of the temple. Kevan shehigiyu lahar hatzofim. When they arrived at Mount Scopus, karu bigdehem, they tore their clothing. Kevan shehigiyu lahar habayit, when they reached the temple mount, ro shual shiyatza mi beikotche hakadoshim, they saw a fox that emerged from the site of the Holy of Holies. Hitchilu hein bochim, Rabbi Akiva mitzachek. They started to weep, and Rabbi Akiva was laughing. Amrulo, they said to him, mipnei ma'ata mitzachek, why are you laughing? Amar lahem, he said to them, mipnei ma'atem bochim, why are you crying? Amrulo, they said to him, Makom shekatuv bo v'hazar hakarev yumat, v'achshav shualim hilchu bo v'lo nifke. Says the Torah says, this is in next week's parasha, that a foreigner who, someone who doesn't belong in the Beis HaMikdash, who comes into the Beis HaMikdash will be killed. And now you have foxes and we shouldn't cry? So Amar Lahen, he said to them, l'chach ani mitzachek, that's why I'm smiling. Dixiv Aida li Aidim Neemanim, as Uriah HaKohen ve Sacharia ben Yivarach Yahu, says that I'm bringing you two witnesses, Uriah HaKohen and Zacharia ben Yivarach Yahu. Vechima inyan Uriah Eitzel Zacharia. What does Uriah have to do with Zacharia? They lived at different periods. Uriah b'mikdash rishon, Zacharia b'mikdash sheni. Uriah lived in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash and Zacharia in the second Beis HaMikdash. Elatala hakasuv nivuaso shel Zacharia b'nivuaso shel Uriah. Rather, we connected the nivuah of Zacharia with the nivuah of Uriah. B'uriah k'siv lachen biglalchem tzion tzadeh teicharesh. Concerning Uriah, the pasuk says in Micha that Zion will be plowed over. B'Zacharia k'siv od yeshvu zakenim uzakenos berechovos Yerushalayim, that the elders will sit on the streets of Jerusalem. Ad shelo nitkayma nivuato shel Uriah hayiti mityarei shelo titkayem nivuato shel Zacharia. Had the prophecy of Uriah that Zion would be plowed over, had it not been fulfilled, I would have been afraid that the prophecy of Zechariah also wouldn't have been fulfilled. Achshav shenitkayma nevuato shel Uriah, biyadua shenevuato shel Zechariah mitkayemet. But now that I know that Uriah's prophecy will be fulfilled, I know that Zechariah's prophecy would be fulfilled. Od yeshvu zekeni muzekenot berechovot Yerushalayim. Bilashon hazeh amrulo, and the rabbis looked at him and they said, Akiva nichamtanu, Akiva nichamtanu, that Rabbi Akiva, you have comforted us. Now this also is an amazing Gemara, because what this Gemara tells you, first of all, it tells you that Rabbi Akiva had a very strong psychological sense. He had an ability to appreciate and to understand what people were, what people were thinking about and what people were worried about, and therefore that they needed him to comfort them. Nich Akiva nichamtanu, Akiva nichamtanu. But much more important than that, what we see about Rabbi Akiva is that Rabbi Akiva is an optimist. Even at the time of the destruction of the temple, Rabbi Akiva was an optimist. And I think that's something that we really need to keep in mind. We talked about the transition, the difficult transition after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. How difficult it must have been for Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to actually, be able to allow Judaism to evolve. To evolve from a Beis HaMikdash-centered Judaism to a Judaism of prayer and a Judaism of study. And you know, if people were going to be negative, if people were going to be pessimistic, if people were going to be depressed, it was going to be very, very hard to make that transition. And therefore, we understand that Rabbi Akiva, in his ability to be an optimist, in his ability in seeing the Beis HaMikdash destroyed and a fox running across the Beis HaMikdash, that he could still be positive, you can understand why that kind of figure, forget how much Torah he knew, just in terms of his attitude, how important he was. So again, you think about Rabbi Akiva, and you think about why he's important, you think about all the opinions that he had, but don't forget the fact that in a real life situation, as someone who was part of the Beis Medrash of Yavne, someone who needed, you know, someone who had a leadership role, the fact that he was an optimist may actually have been the most important piece of the puzzle. That is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, who came to study late, Rabbi Akiva, who's humble, Rabbi Akiva, who's an optimist, and of course, Rabbi Akiva is a man of principle. Rabbi Akiva, who's one of the Asara Haruge Malchus, someone who gave his life for the study of Torah. B'chol levavcha u'v'chol nafshecha u'v'chol meyodecha, says Rabbi Akiva, b'chol meyodecha, afilu no telas nafshecha, that you have to give your life for God. And that's what he did. He gave his life for the study of Torah. That's Rabbi Akiva. Let's hold Rabbi Akiva for a minute. And let's look interestingly at Rabbi Akiva's Rebbe, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. He's a little more complicated, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. First of all, it's not so clear. It's interesting. There are two traditions about his youth. One opinion is that he began, like a Rabbi Akiva story, he began working in his wealthy father's estate, that he decided to learn Torah, that he left home for Jerusalem. His father disowned him, but then when he saw what a great scholar he was, he re-embraced him. The other opinion is, of course, that he was a great scholar from the beginning. But when we look at the Mishnah, the famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, you get a whole different feel about Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus than you do about Rabbi Akiva. First of all, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Kibel Mihilel v'Shamai, and the chain of tradition, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, received the tradition from Hillel and Shammai. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had five students. One of them was Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. And says the Mishnah about Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus bor sud she'eno ma'abei tipa. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is a plastered cistern which loses not a drop. That's how smart he was. And just a little bit weighs down in the Mishnah, who Huaya Omer, Im yiyu kochach me Yisrael b'chaf maznayim, ve'Eliezer ben Hyrcanus b'kaf shnia machriaz kula. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai used to say, if all the sages of Israel were on one scale of the balance, and Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus was on the other scale, he would outweigh them all. Now, here you have a different sense. Rabbi Akiva, as great as he was, the stories in the Gemara, the stories in the Mishnah don't emphasize his greatness in Torah. They talk about how he was humble. They talk about how he was refined. They talked about how he was an optimist. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus has a completely different personality. He's the smart one. He's the one who's like, you know, frighteningly smart. He's smarter than everybody. And interestingly, I didn't give you this source, but interestingly, his smartness has a rigidity to it. Rigidity in the sense that sometimes he's smart, even though he becomes a contrarian in his smartness. What do I mean? The Gemara says about Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus that he followed Shammai's opinion. Now, Shammai was an interesting character because the Gemara in a number of places says that Shammai was smarter than Hillel, or Beis Shammai were smarter than the yeshiva of Hillel, but that Hillel's view was accepted because Hillel was, in a sense, kinder than Shammai, or the students of Hillel were kinder than the students of Shammai. So Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus has a very tough side to him. Very smart, but very tough. And to appreciate why the personality of these people is so important, I want to just take a few minutes now. Take a few minutes now and study with you the story of Tanur Shalachnai. Maybe the most famous story in the entire Talmud. The story from Bava Metzia, Nun Tet Amud Bet. But I want to study it in a way that I think you probably never studied it before. I want to study it as the moment when these two personalities, Rabbi Akiva the student, Rabbi Akiva is Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus' student, the one who's refined and humbled and optimistic, when he comes in conflict with his teacher, the brilliant yet stubborn yet contrarian, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. V'zehu tanur shel achnai, says the Gemara. Mai achnai, what is achnai? Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, Sheikifu devarim ke'achna zu v'timuhu. Basically, the achnai probably means that achnai is a snake, and they surrounded it with arguments like a snake. Leave that aside. That has to do with the context of the Gemara. Ba'oto hayom, on that day, Heshiv Rabbi Eliezer, this Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, called Shuvos Sheba'ula. Rabbi Eliezer, basically what was happening in the Beis Medrash was that there was an argument about whether this oven of Achnai was Tameh or not, was ritually impure. Rabbi Eliezer was on one side and all the rabbis were on the other side. You know that feeling in the Beis Medrash when everybody is on one side and there's only one on the other side. And just remember that Rabbi Eliezer, according to the Mishnah, was smarter than everybody else. But that day, Rabbi Eliezer suggested all the answers in the world, all the explanations to prove that he was right. V'lo kiblu heimenu, but they didn't accept it from him. Amar lahem, he said to them, Im halacha kimoti, if the halacha is like me, charuv zeh yochiach, let this carob tree prove me right. Nekar charuv mimekomo meya ama, the amri la arba meyot ama. This carob tree was uprooted 100 ama, and some people say 400 ama. Pretty impressive, right? He must be right. If the carob tree's uprooted, he must be right. Amru lo ein mevin raya min hacharuv. The rabbis are not impressed. They say you can't bring a proof from a carob tree. Chazar v'amar lohem im halacha kemoti amatamayim yochichu. He says, if the halacha follows me, then let the stream of water prove that I'm right. Chazru amatamayim v'achorehem. And the stream of water started flowing backwards. Amru lo ein mevin raya me'amatamayim. We can't bring a proof from the stream of water. Chazar v'amra lahem im halacha kemoti kotle beit hamedrash yochichu. If halacha is like me, let the walls of the Beis Medrash prove that I'm right. Hitu kotle beit hamedrash lipol. And the walls of the Beis Medrash began to fall. Gar b'hem Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua screamed at the walls. Amar lahem im talmidei chachamim minatzkim ze'ezeh b'halacha atem mativchem. He says, walls, what are you getting involved in this fight for? And says the Gemara, kind of says the editor of the Gemara, lo naflu mipnei kvodo shel Rabbi Yehoshua v'lo zakfu mipnei kvodo shel Rabbi Eliezer. Says they didn't fall because of the honor of Rabbi Yehoshua. But they didn't return to their upright position because the honor of Rabbi Eliezer. Ve'adayin matin ve'omdin. And they're still slanted. Chazar ve'amar lahem. Im halacha kimoti mina shamayim yochichu. If the halacha is like me, let it be proved from heaven, says Rabbi Eliezer. Yatz dabat kol v'amra. The heavenly voice comes out and says, ma lachem eitzel Rabbi Eliezer. Shehalacha kimoto b'chol makom. The halacha follows him in every case. Amad Rabbi Yoshua ragla v'amar lo bashamayim. Says, no. The determination of the halacha is not in heaven. Mai lo bashamayim hi. Amar Rabbi Yirmiya shekvar nitna Torah mehar Sinai ein anu mashkichim b'basko. Says, once the Torah is given on Sinai, we don't listen to the heavenly voices anymore. Shekvar kasavta b'har Sinai b'Torah achrei rabim lahatos. The Torah says, follow the majority. Here, the majority is against Rabbi Eliezer. So basically, the heavenly voice comes down and says, the halacha follows Rabbi Eliezer, and they reject that. He says, lo b'shamayim. Then the Gemara has an amazing postscript. Ashkechei Rabbi Natan Leliyahu. Rabbi Natan found Eliyahu Hanavi. He met Eliyahu Hanavi. Amar Lei, Rabbi Natan asked Eliyahu Hanavi, Mayavi Rakalish Baruchu Bishayshata. What's God doing at this moment? Amar Lei Kachie, he's smiling. V'yamar Nitzchuni Banai, Nitzchuni Banai. Says, my children have defeated me. The Maritzchias in his commentary in the Gemara, you can look in the back of the Gemara in Baba Metzia, says the word Nitzchuni comes from the word Netzach Yisrael. That Nitzchuni Banai, through arguing about my Torah, you actually eternalize me. So here we go. There's a debate between Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim. Rabbi Eliezer is defeated by the Chachamim. Even though the heavenly voice comes and says that Rabbi Eliezer is right, the rabbis reject Rabbi Eliezer. But it seems to be that this was a major moment in the Beis Medrash, that people were not willing just to let this go. It wasn't like, okay, he's wrong, let's move on. Because the Gemara says, Amru oto hayom heviu kotaros shetir Rabbi Eliezer usrafum ba'esh. They brought all the things Rabbi Eliezer had said were tahar, and they burnt him in the fire. They rejected not only this opinion of Rabbi Eliezer, but they rejected all his opinion. V'nimnu alav, and they voted concerning him, uberchuhu, and they decided to excommunicate him. And now the key line for what we want. V'amru miyelech v'yodio. Who's going to go and tell Rabbi Eliezer that he has been excommunicated, right? The rabbis up to now have been Rabbi Yoshua and Rabbi Yirmiya. Says, who's the rabbi who's going to tell him that he's been excommunicated? Amar lahem Rabbi Akiva. Our friend Rabbi Akiva says, Ani Yelech, I'll go. Shema Yelech Adam Sheino Hagun V'yodio. V'nimtza Machriv Es Kol Ha'olam Kulo. Says, I'll go, because I'm afraid someone who's not worthy will tell him. And he was so smart. His intelligence was like fire. He was afraid that through his intelligence, he would burn the whole world. Ma'asa Rabbi Akiva, what does Rabbi Akiva do? Lavash shechorim v'nisatev shechorim. He puts on black clothing. V'yashav lefanav berichuk arba amos. And he sits at a distance of 4 amos. Amar lo Rabbi Akiva, Amar lo Rabbi Eliezer, Akiva mayomi yomayim. Why are you treating me differently today than the other day? Come closer. Amar lo Rabbi, kimeduma li shechaverim bedilim mimcha. Says, it seems to me that our friends are separating themselves from you. Afukara begada vechalat min olav, v'nishmat v'yashav al gabe karka. Says, and Rabbi Eliezer responds by, again, by also, in a sense, sitting Shiva for his, for the situation that's been created. But I think that this idea is an extremely important idea, this moment. Rabbi Eliezer, the great Rabbi Eliezer, the stubborn Rabbi Eliezer, the Eliezer who's smarter than everybody else, but just had that difficult streak in him. And he stands up against everybody And he loses. Basically, he loses. The rabbis say, Lo bashamayim he, the halacha is not like you. But they get angry at him and they say, the halacha is not like you. And you know what? We're going to reject you. We're going to excommunicate you. We're throwing you out of the Beis Medrash. We don't want to give you a place in the Beis Medrash anymore. And who is it that goes and informs Rabbi Eliezer? And again, they're afraid of Rabbi Eliezer. We know that type, right? You're afraid Rabbi Eliezer is the brilliant one, the scholar. Who knows what he's going to do, right? When he gets angry at everybody because they've excommunicated him. Not only has he been humiliated, but now he's been excommunicated. What's going to happen now that he's been excommunicated? And it's Rabbi Akiva. Which Rabbi Akiva? That's the Rabbi Akiva. Back to the very first story. That's the Rabbi Akiva that the daughter of Kalba Savua saw, that he was humble and that he was refined. That was the Rabbi Akiva that the daughter of Kalba Savua said, this man is special. Not this man is special that he knows more Torah than anybody else. Sure, that's what happened, right? He spent 24 years and he had 24,000 students and he became the great Rabbi Akiva. But you can't understand the story of Tanur Shalachnai unless you understand that very first story about Rabbi Akiva and his wife and the story of Kalba Savua. You can't understand why Rabbi Akiva is the one who's chosen or chooses himself to be the one who approaches Rabbi Eliezer, because it's only the humility of the student, the refinement of the student, that allowed Rabbi Eliezer to accept the decree of his colleagues. And I bring these stories and I end with the story of Tanur Shalachnai because I think that's really a way to finish up the discussion of the literature of the Second Temple period. We started with religious literature, the story of Susanna and the elders, and we saw religious literature that was not accepted, right? We saw that they were critical of the Zakenim of the elders and they didn't accept the literature. We saw Josephus, who's an amazing secular historian, but the rabbis didn't really like him. For whatever reason, they saw him as a traitor. That was last week's discussion. And now we see the literature, the religious literature, that actually was accepted by the rabbis, that became the Gemara that we study each and every day, that is really has guided Judaism. And we think of the Gemara as being a collection of laws and a collection of, collection of directives that shaped and created the legal system in which we live. And of course, that's true. But I think when we study the literature of this period, what's most important or what's equally important is to remember the fact that these books are written by regular people and that it's their personalities and their quirks and their good and their pros and their cons and their good qualities and their negative qualities and their difficult qualities and their qualities that make them easy to get along with people. That's really what created the work of the Talmud that we have. It's not a usual way of studying Gemara. That's not what the legal codes were interested in. But as we're studying the literature, I think it's an important piece to consider. I apologize for the fact that the Zoom did not work well today. I thank you everybody for your patience. And I look forward, we'll say next week is the Medical Ethics Conference. I'm sure everybody is gonna participate. And please God, after Shavuos, we'll be able to continue these classes and we'll continue a new series. Have a great week, everybody. Stay safe, and it's a treat to study with everybody else.